Okay, without further ado, I am going to introduce our next speaker, who came to me when she was, I think, not quite 2 years sober and said, "Karen, I want to work the steps." I said, "Okay, let's start getting into your house on Saturdays after the women's meeting." And so we did. And so she did. And 10 years later, she's still sober because that's how it works. And I'm thrilled to have her come up here and tell you her story. She is an amazing woman, Amy from Bellingham, Washington. This goes. And that's Bliss. Now, how do you want this? Is this good? Can we go down?
Oh, all right.
Okay. I'll let you know when you're 5 minutes to the end.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Amy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Grateful to be here. Grateful to be sober today. Thank you for everyone on the committee who put this luncheon together. Thank you, Karen, for inviting me here. I have friends that traveled along with me. My great friend Julie is here. She won $50, so now she doesn't get to claim that it was all for waste coming with me. But without her, I could not have done this. And Karen, thank you so much for inviting me. I am humbled to be here and grateful to share my story. If we get to 15, 20 minutes and I'm still in Chico drinking, please somebody tell me to move on. Because I don't want to spend all of my time telling you all of the garbage I went through and a wreckage that I made. I'm going to start with the St. Francis prayer just to get me going. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there is hatred, I may bring love. That where there is wrong, I may bring a spirit of forgiveness. That where there is discord, I may bring harmony. That where there is error, I may bring truth. Where there is doubt, I may bring faith. That where there is despair, I may bring hope. Where there are shadows, I may bring light. Where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Grant that I may seek rather than to comfort than to be comforted. To understand rather than to be understood, and to love rather than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds, it is by forgetting that one is forgiven, and it is by dying that one is awakened to eternal life. Amen.
Amen.
All right, my sobriety date is Christmas Eve, 2015. I may tell you a little bit about how that came to be. My last drink was December 4th of 2015. I did not have intent to get clean and sober and stay clean and sober. I needed to stop drinking because I needed to stay out of jail. And that was probably about as far as I was planning to get. Grateful that I was introduced to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and that due to my God doing for me what I could not do for myself, I got clean and sober, and I have not put any mind or mood altering substances in my body since the 24th of December of 2015. I was born and raised in Fairbanks, Alaska. I was adopted. I knew I was adopted from a baby. My parents, I always thought that made me special. My parents loved me. They're still together to this day. With over 50 years of marriage. I would say they're happily married, but my mom wakes up about 6 in the morning and goes to bed about 8 o'clock at night. My dad wakes up about 11, eats, takes a nap from 2 to 5, does errands from 5 to 9, and then stays up till 5 in the morning. She said, "I don't know how we live together." And I said, "I do." That's how they live together. But I had a loving family growing up. I had an older brother that was also adopted. He did not have a lot of interest in the fact that he was adopted. He was like, "Why would I ever want to meet those people? They're strangers." I felt blessed to have been adopted because I knew I was given a gift. I always wanted to know my adopted family, or my biological family. I was able to meet my biological mother at, I guess I was 22 years old. So I did not, you know, my childhood, like I said, my mom was a second grade teacher. My dad was a long haul truck driver. He made a lot of money on the pipeline up in Alaska. And so we were spoiled as kids. We got to do everything. We got to go on any trips that we want. We went skiing. We came to Bellingham once a year to see grandma and grandpa. We went to Hawaii. I had no excuse to be an alcoholic. But those of you know, alcoholism does not care who you are, what you've done, how much money you have, how spoiled you were, how great your childhood was. If you're an alcoholic, you're an alcoholic. I believe that I was born an alcoholic. I believe I will die an alcoholic. I hope to die a sober alcoholic. But I didn't stay a sober alcoholic after birth for too long. I do know, though, that my biological mother is in recovery. I found that out about 5 years after I got sober. She's about 5 years longer in recovery than me. So there is a biological component to this. Let's see, I had a pony growing up when I was in fifth grade. I got a pony, or my parents helped me buy my own pony. I lived about two blocks away from the horse farm on a rural road in Alaska. I downhill skied. I was a downhill ski racer. I played softball, competitive softball. I heard a speaker at our luncheon recently talk about, and I hear almost everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about how they felt uncomfortable in their skin. And I was talking to my sponsor as I was thinking about what I was going to share today, and hearing other people share, and I said, I mean, I know I felt that way, but if someone looked at me externally, and when I look back at what my life was like, I was like, you were popular, you were captain of the softball team, I had tons of friends, I was with the popular group that bullied everybody, so, I mean, like, why did I feel comfortable in my own skin? But I did. You know, I ended up being student body president of the high school, I was prom queen. Granted, both of those things were on the same ballot, so I think that was by accident that happened. But still, like, you couldn't have told me that I was pretty, that I was smart, that I was good. I just didn't feel that, or if I felt any of those things, I didn't feel it enough. So when I was, you know, I started smoking cigarettes, probably fifth grade. I can't tell you when my first drink was. I know I wanted to do it again, but I know one of the first times that I got drunk and experienced external consequences was when I was 12 years old. I think it was either 12 or 13. I was in the eighth grade. School bus picked me up at 9 in the morning in Alaska. It was still dark. I was at the piano, practicing my piano in the morning, drinking my mix of some clear unbrand name tequila and mixture of like koala soda and juice or whatever out of a straw, wasted before the bus picked me up, took a couple bottles of it with me onto the bus, shared with some people, got to school and was like, I don't think I should be at school because I am intoxicated. So my friend and I were like, we can't be here, we're gonna get caught, so we skipped school. We went to the mall, we shoplifted some stuff, but we got bored, right, because we started sober up, I don't know. But we decided we would have someone from the mall call the school and say, oh, they've been sick at appointments, they're coming back to school, so we came back to school. I was sitting in my orchestra class, rosy red cheeks, and I saw one of the attendants, school ushers, run in with this bright green slip of paper. The bright green slip of paper meant you were going to the principal's office, and that this was not the first one I had ever gotten, but I knew what this one was for, and I knew I was busted. Somebody had passed a note earlier on in school and said, oh my God, wasn't it funny how drunk Amy and Jill were on the bus, blah, 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 and then they ratted on us. I would get back at that girl my senior year in high school, because I held on to that. But I got kicked out of school. I went to a 3-day like graduated reentry program. For the days I was suspended from school, I got kicked off the bus for the rest of the year. And I didn't drink. But a year to the day after that, I was on a ski trip and I toasted to my friends with a drink. about how I, congratulations, you're not an alcoholic. You've gone a year without drinking. Clearly, I'd proven to myself. Well, at 12 or 13 years old, when you are contemplating or celebrating that you are not an alcoholic, you may be an alcoholic. So after that time period, I drank whenever I could. We stole liquor from the Chinese restaurant. We drove snowmobiles, so we would park. We'd drive up to the front. A couple of us would jump out, run through the restaurant, grab the liquor out of the kitchen, run out the back of the restaurant, jump on the snowmobiles, and go. So I used to store my alcohol in the snowbank. My dad taught me before I learned the important lesson that because alcohol doesn't freeze, if you store it in the snowbank and it gets below freezing, the alcohol, the temperature of the liquid will actually go below freezing and burn you from the inside out. I don't know why my dad told me that, but he told me that before I had to learn it myself, and so I'm grateful for that. But, you know, it's a lesson that in high school not a lot of people are learning. My dad shared with me that he was an alcoholic, but he, you know, just didn't drink. Right? So I didn't know what that was. I didn't have a lot of drinking around the house. I didn't care about what other people were doing when they were drinking because I would get blackout drunk. I was blackout drunk from the get-go, and if I didn't get blackout drunk, then what was the point? Let's see. Junior year in high school, I went to Junior Olympics in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. We followed, me and my roommate at the time, followed this couple of guys from, I guess they ended up being from Florida, onto the elevator where they had cases of liquor, and we said, hey, here's $20, will you go get us some alcohol? I woke up the next morning, which was the first race of the Junior Olympics, in my bed, hair covered in puke, pissed on my pants, and had missed the morning run at 6:30 and was missing the inspection of the ski course. Not really a big deal. I was like, oh God, wash myself up, get on the ski hill, do what I needed to do. I was probably hungover, but it didn't really matter. I didn't get caught, but that was one of those poor choices, bad outcome, and I should have got caught. The one time that I think, like, in hindsight, well, that's not true, it's not the one time, but senior year in high school, we went to the state high school softball championships. After we lost, my coaches bought me my first bottle of Crown Royal. After that, Crown Royal was my drink of choice. I could drink it. I drank it with RC Cola, Royal Crown Cola with Crown Royal drink. I would black out before I would puke. That was my answer. But we got wasted and ended up breaking into the coach's rooms with the keys that we had snuck and dumping 5-gallon buckets of ice water from the garbage cans onto their beds. I remember doing that, but the next thing I remember was waking up on a Greyhound school bus sitting next to my mother 200 miles away, driving to my hometown, back from the state championships. I had no idea what had happened at breakfast. I had gone, I had sat through breakfast, maybe I had eaten, the coaches had threatened to quit, the hotel was threatening to sue us, the water damage we had caused to the mattresses in the building was horrific, and they blamed it on the sophomores. It was awesome. It wasn't until later that summer, someone was like, haha, wasn't it funny what Amy and Megan did to you at state championships? I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. So that was high school for me. I drank as much as I could, whenever I could. I was an equal opportunity drug and alcohol user. If it made me feel different, I wanted it. I believe in the singleness of purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I know that my story includes problems other than alcohol. A lot of people reference those as outside issues. When I read the literature, they're referred to as problems other than alcohol, and I have them, all of them. My drug of choice was more, and preferably more of yours. So I then graduated high school from Alaska. Like I said, I wanted to get as far away from Alaska as I could, and my parents, I moved 2,000 miles away to Chico, California in 1999. Chico at that time, I think, was the number 2 party school in the nation on Playboy's list of party schools. and I was in right where I wanted to be. I did not go to class very much, and I got equal amount of credits towards my degree as I went to class, which was also not very much. But I had a lot of fun. I made a lot of friends. I lived in the dorms. And it was just a culture shock for me moving to Chico. But that was probably where I got exposed to most of my outside issues, because as a college student, quite frankly, it's way easier to get things other than alcohol until you're 21, because you need somebody to get them for you anyway. At 21, you can get your alcohol. So let's see. In 2002, I went off a downhill ski jump at Squaw Valley at Lake Tahoe. I flipped upside down. I flew 101 feet in the air and landed on my head. I broke my neck. I broke my femur, dislocated my hip, collapsed a lung, and spent the next 19 days in ICU. I was on a ventilator. When they took me off the ventilator, because I was pulling the tubes out of my mouth, they had to put me back on because I had pneumonia. I could not breathe on my own. From that moment forward, I worked very hard, and I was desperate to get off the ventilator and to be able to breathe on my own and to not have a tracheotomy. They were going to cut a hole in my throat and help me breathe that way as I continued on. But they told me it was very likely I was never going to walk again. I wanted to know if my ski boots were still on. And when they told me they weren't, I knew I was in trouble, because my ski boots were really tight. The tighter they were, the more control that you had, and that I was a racer, right? They said no. I also remember on the way up to the hill, telling my friends, if something happens, do not put me in an ambulance. Don't let them put me in the ambulance. My dad will kick my butt over an ambulance bill. Well, when they started talking about a helicopter, I was like, oh man, this better be good. Well, it was good. I was really adamant that I was going to walk. It was going to be mind over matter. I was going to the best rehab hospital in Colorado. It was Spinal Cord Injury Hospital. And as I was, you know, joking with the doctors in the ER or in the ICU, the doctor told me, he said, look, I just have to tell you that it really depends. I didn't have a complete spinal cord injury. I was incomplete, so it's possible that you could recover any or all of what you've lost, but it really depends upon how bad you crushed your spinal cord. And he said, you crushed yours really good. And so he said, if your back decides not to let you walk again, you will not walk again. And you know, that was not that incredibly devastating to me. For some reason, up until this point, I had not had the best attitude. I would, you know, when we lost our state softball championships, I was in the grass in the next field, ripping it up, screaming about the sophomores. That's why I wasn't too sad that they got blamed for everything. But for some reason, I decided that, you know, I was gonna live. Life was gonna be really different, and life could be really crappy, and I could have a lot of reasons to be miserable. But if I was going to live, it was gonna be a long time to be miserable. And I just decided not to do that. I told my parents I'm going back to, so this was in, I got out of the rehab hospital in June of 2022. I asked the doctor, can I go back to school in August? She said, maybe. My mom said January. I said August. Mom said January. I said, what am I gonna do till January? Like sit around and be, you know, whatever. When the doctor said maybe, I won. So I went back to school in August of 2002. And I finished my undergraduate degree and graduated with a degree in construction management in 2005. I finally started getting good grades. It was a miracle what happened when you actually went to class. When I went to my first class on Friday, I was like, holy criminy, nobody's here on Fridays. So when you showed up on Fridays, it was like extra credit. I'm here on a Friday. And I got to learn what they taught on Fridays, and so that was also on the test, and I got to know what was on the test on Fridays. Let's see, what request my time. Oh God, 18 minutes and I'm still in Chico getting drunk. I decided I wanted to make more money. I needed to make more money than I could in construction management. So I wanted to go do construction law. I moved to Waco, Texas, at Baylor University, and I went to law school. The two schools that I got into that I was interested in were Baylor Law, which was the biggest Baptist university in the world, and Arizona State, which had at that point just became number one party school in the nation on Playboy's list of party schools. And I thought, you know, I partied enough here at Chico. I could probably use a little bit of God in my life. That was not a whole lot of what was going on at Baylor, but people there didn't drink like I did, and so I didn't drink much with them. I did a whole lot of isolated drinking. I lived with my mother. When I got injured, my mother moved in with me. She was going to make sure that I got through school, and then she went to law school with me as well. I graduated law school with a business litigation major in 2008, and I looked for a job in Texas. I wanted to stay in Texas. It was warm there. I loved it. Wasn't too interested in other issues in Texas, but there were horses and it was warm and that's where I wanted to stay. But it was 2008, I couldn't find a job, I couldn't find any housing, and mom had given up enough of her life that it was time that mom was able to get her life back. She was born and raised in Bellingham. After she finally drug my dad out of Alaska, they bought a house in Bellingham and she and my dad stayed together but lived apart for the whole time that I was in school. So I just said, okay, I'm going to Bellingham. I was never gonna come and stay in Washington. Washington is way too rainy for me and it's way too cold. So I ended up back in Bellingham. Economy was in such the toilet, I could not find a job. But lo and behold, I had an alcoholic uncle that worked at the liquor store. Back when in Washington, only liquor was sold at liquor stores, so you weren't going and buying groceries and liquor, you were just getting liquor. And the director of the public defender's office also was an alcoholic and spent a lot of time at that liquor store. He had given my uncle a card, you know, because you get to know your liquor store convenience clerk, and with the phone number on the back of it. And so I said, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I want to work. And so in 2010, I passed the bar in Washington State, and then, well, I passed the legal bar. I still wasn't passing any other bar. But I got my license to practice law in Washington, and I went to work for the public defender's office, volunteered. I called them, I said, I need an appointment, shop with the boss. His legal assistant was a B, and was like, you can't just call here and get an appointment. Well, then I flipped the card over and I called the cell phone number on the back of it. He goes, yeah, just call my legal assistant. Tell her to set up an appointment. And I was like, I just talked to him. He told me to call. So I got into public defense. I never wanted to do criminal law. I never wanted to do family law. I thought it was going to be devastating, but it was so fascinating. It was so fascinating. There has never been a dull moment. So I landed exactly where I was supposed to be, and I can't imagine doing anything ever again different, but there was a lot of reason to drink. Everything I saw was a reason to drink. Every time I prevailed, overcame the odds of public defense was an extra reason to drink more. And then every time that I got beat down, which is what you do as a public defender, was a reason to drink. I started sleeping with a married guy at my office. When his wife decided to leave him, I was like, well, then that's perfect. Why don't you move in with me? He moved in with me. I became involved in an extremely emotionally abusive relationship. It got physical, I think, a couple of times that I don't remember. And one time that I do, I did not have the power to get out of that relationship. But when he went away to Germany, I had talked to a coworker, agreed to let him move in there, agreed to let him store his stuff in his house for at least 30 days. And my sister and brother-in-law came over with a U-Haul and moved his stuff out of my house. When they called me and said, we're coming over, I said, it's really rainy, I don't think it's a good day for moving. They were like, we got a U-Haul, we're coming. I sat on the couch and I cried while they moved this abusive man out of my house and really saved my life, or gave me the opportunity that I would take advantage of later. I got my first DUI in 2011. I ran my van, my wheelchair accessible van, straight into a light pole. When the cops came and said, "Ma'am, do you know where you are?" I said, "Yeah, I'm on Broadway and Meridian." They said, "No, you're on F Street in Cornwall." I said, "I'm calling bullshit on that." lo and behold, I was on F Street in Cornwall. And so when my parents asked me the next day, "Well, where's your vehicle?" I was like, "Let's look at the ticket." I also, when they took me out of the van, out of my van, I got on the sidewalk and was like, "Well, I got a fast wheelchair, just zoom." I took off down the sidewalk. Officer clicked my wheelchair off and I stopped abruptly, and they ended up taking me to jail, arresting me. I made some really dumb comments. The man that I was with at the time gave me a ride home after telling me, "Amy, why don't you just shut the F up?" But at that point, you know, there was no help. I had totaled my van. I am so grateful that I did not kill anyone else. I did not kill myself. I did not injure my service dog at that time. But I did not stop drinking. I went and lied my way through my alcohol evaluation. The alcohol evaluator, after $200, told me I had no significant problem. Well, the hood of my van and the fact that my engine had choked the differential back into my rear differential, or my engine drivetrain, back into the rear differential about 8 inches, told a different story. They said your problem was more than not significant, but very significant. I continued to drink, but I knew I didn't want to. At that point, I tried to stop drinking, and I just couldn't. I tried every imaginable remedy. I did not have it in the house. I did not drink, or I would only have it in the house. I wouldn't ever drink outside. All of the things that More About Alcoholism talks about, I tried. It didn't work. I had sent people as part of my job as a public defender to Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. It was a mandatory requirement of doing a deferred prosecution, and I had no idea other than admit to God you were powerless. I didn't even know the unmanageability. I kind of thought that was a cop-out. It was really all I knew about AA, because I thought, well, I mean, you admit you're powerless, then you just absolve yourself of your own responsibility. Well, I am not responsible for my alcoholism, but I am responsible for my recovery. In 2015, on December 4th, I was driving home from the bar after work. I hit a curb and ran into, got high-centered on the Pickett Street Bridge, which was less than a block away from the jail. They asked, "Ma'am, have you been drinking?" I said, "Yes." They said, "How much have you had to drink?" And I said, "Not enough." I thought that I was DUI proof because you couldn't make me do field sobriety tests, and because I'm in a wheelchair, you're never going to get into the jail for a breathalyzer. Well, when you run in inanimate objects, they don't need field sobriety tests. They can say this is poor driving that might have been affected by alcohol. And when you crash a block away from the jail, they can take you in one of their little wheelchairs and drive you across the street. That was my last drink. I decided at that point I needed to go to treatment. My dad was like, "Don't you think that's a little excessive?" He probably will still speak to me about moderation. I'm like, "Yeah, but I don't do moderation in anything." I'm an alcoholic. I just have one drinker or two. I'm like, "Well, then you're not an alcoholic." I wanted to go to a fancy rehab hospital, probably down here in Malibu. You know, maybe wherever it was going to be a massage. They were going to tell me I was a good person. I was going to be able to float around in a pool. And I ended up in Kirkland, Washington, raining in the end of December. And they told me, "You have a disease. If you continue to drink, you are going to die." That is exactly what I needed to hear. I was told I could never use alcohol again. My disease was progressive, and if I didn't stop, or if I started again, I would start right off where I left. So that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to a 12-step program. It was called Residence 12. It was a women's program. I am so grateful for my relationship with women and the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. I fortunately learned the valuable importance of women's friendship right after I got injured. It didn't take me all the way until I got to the rooms. I got injured. My guy friends did not know what to do with me. They were like, well, you can't come play horse and basketball and, you know, run around the streets with the what, how good are you as a friend anymore? My female friends were there for me, and so I knew that. I know a lot of people come into these rooms and are like, F women. Well, I spent my whole life like that as well. But the women in Alcoholics Anonymous have saved my life. I do go to mixed meetings. I appreciate that, but it is with the women that I am able to bond and share and live and really, you know, flourish in what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was told you have to change everything. You can't go do your own same job. You can't go back to your same house. You can't have the same friends. All of that was something I had to go back to. I was going back to the same job with the same, I didn't have any friends. They were only the people I worked with. And then, and so I was scared, but I went back and I immersed myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to four or five meetings a week for the first, four or five AA meetings a week for the first probably 3 years of my sobriety. I went to Narcotics Anonymous meetings throughout the day too. Those are the reasons the prosecutors in my hometown had not been murdered. Those were nooners, and so I would run up the street and I would get a little bit of, I don't need to kill anybody, I probably shouldn't, and then I would go back to work for the rest of the day. I considered myself bisexual for the first 3 years of my sobriety. I was engaged in both 12-step programs. I took my chips up both places, and it's been amazing. So let's talk a little bit about step one for me. Got me where I was, but what I realized was the importance of step B, or part B. Step one, part B, is that my life had become unmanageable. Up until the point I got sober, I was like, I pay my bills, I go to work, I do my thing, I get my paycheck, leave me alone. But the reality was I could not manage myself, I could not manage you, I could not manage my life. But rather than, you know, I'm a bad person and that's why I can't do this, it's just I'm not management material. So when I start grasping about controlling things again, I have to remember, Amy, you're a poor manager. You're a poor manager, but most importantly, I do have a better manager, and that is my higher power. And I turn that over to him, and then when I start trying to wrestle control of life, life can go a little smoother. And step two came to believe I had a great understanding of who my higher power was. I had a spiritual experience early on, and when I was 16 years old, that's when I accepted Jesus as my higher power, and that has stuck with me. I was blessed with the gift of faith. I know it's a gift, and it is a childlike faith. I'm just like, sorry if it bothers you that I can't answer your questions about what I believe, but that's what I believe, and that's your problem. And, you know, that's helpful for me. It's not helpful for you. And if you have a problem with me not being able to explain it to you, then maybe we have a problem. But that's okay, because I will move on. There are other people that don't care if I'm able to explain myself or defend my belief. So step two was not a problem for me. I know that it is for a lot of people. I hear it in the rooms, and what I would like to say is that if you look back just one step and realize that you were powerless over alcohol, it was very easy for me to say, I know what my higher power is, but for the rest of you all, alcohol was our higher power for so long. Why is it not possible that there could be an infinite number of things that also had more power than us? And because of where alcohol took me in a negative direction, I believe that there are many other powers that can take us in the right direction. Step three, say the third step prayer every morning. I say the seventh step prayer every morning. As soon as I hit the door, I probably grab my will back and then head out the door with my own will, but say thank you, God, for listening to those words. But here, I have it from here. But the words that I say are the words out of the big book. They are for myself to thee, to do with me as that thou wilt. If I don't use the wilt and the thou and the thee, I get lazy and I get complacent and I say some shorter prayer and then I don't say any prayer at all. I know a lot of people that say some beautiful prayers. Karen wrote hers out for me. It's very eloquent. It speaks to the same message of help me, God. I can't do this on my own, and thank you, God. So there is many more than the actual prayer in the big book, but that is what works for me, and if I am not diligent about that, I forget that, and it is a game changer in my life. So let's see, step four. I had to do a personal inventory. It was a house cleaning. I had so much garbage inside of me that there was no room to put the good that I was learning from AA. There was nowhere to put the healthy practices of life and to find out who I was. I didn't know who I was. I was a chameleon. I would be whoever you wanted me to be so that you would give me what I wanted. When I did my fourth step, I learned a lot about the patterns of my behavior. I got into the steps right away. I was told, get a sponsor. I got a sponsor. My sponsor told me to go to meetings. She told me to get a home group. She told me to chair meetings because at that point she said, nobody wants to hear what you have to say. If you chair, you don't share and you can listen. She was right about that, but that also gave me some accountability in the rooms and I needed to show up because I said I would be there. She also told me to get a service position. I did that from the get-go and I've had one the entire time I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. Step five, so I admitted to God, myself, and to another human being. The admission to another human being is crucial for my perspective because no matter how much I wanted to fill out the fourth column, I didn't have any part in this. It wasn't my fault, it was theirs. They did it first, or yes, but, yes, but, yes, but. But my sponsor was able to walk me through, and the first time I went through the steps, it was not with Karen, but she walked me through the steps, and she said, here's your part, here's your part, here's your part. And based on those patterns of behavior, she was able to show me those defects of character and identify and label them. I would have never been able to do that on my own, and I would have been lost there with all of my garbage from the fourth step. I have since, after doing the sixth step, which was just pretty immediately in the room right after my fifth step, started saying the seventh step prayer. I had most of my list for step eight made in the fourth step. However, what I realized was that I owed amends to people that and things that I did not resent. You know, I wasn't mad at Albertsons for all the shit I stole from them. I wasn't mad at Domino's Pizza for the enterprising I did when the store closed and I started selling their pizza for $5 a piece after the fact, put money in my pocket to get drunk on their dime. But that was harm that I did that I needed to make amends for. It's true. Some of those amends didn't go directly back to the corporations that were harmed, but I have since made amends to those places for the harm that I did, and I had to look outside of just the people that made me mad and the people that I hurt, because there were people, places, and institutions, and I had to get right with all of those. Step nine, probably the most difficult one for me, was my sister-in-law, and the reason that was is because when I sat down with her and I said, I work in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know I hurt you, I did this, this, and this, is there anything I forgot? She said, oh yeah, why don't you sit down? You know, most of the rest of my amends, people were like, oh, we love you, I'm just glad to see you sober, and it was beautiful, right? She told me the truth. She was like, oh no, you forgot a few things, honey. But she also has forgiven me and celebrates my sobriety with me and is grateful to see me living the life that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. I will tell you, I am not the big book picture of step 10. So when I go back, when I go to step 10, because I do not do a diligent 10 step on a regular basis, I end up back in step 4 a lot. I would encourage you all not to do that. If you do the 10th step, you don't end up having to do a 4th step. But there are people in my life that, you know, I talked to my sponsor this last week. I said, you know, she's like, you know, I mean, there are 4 people. The prosecutors, your job, the justice system, your mom. You know, there are people with me that I pretty continuously need to do a 4 step. But she said, if we think about it, you probably have to do a 10 step on them every day because my irritation with them, that resentment, crops up. I am, for the most part, able to let that go and start anew the next day. And so there was a point in which I was like, well, it's not resentment because they just keep pissing me off. Well, that's not true because I put myself in a position where I stepped on other people's toes and then they retaliated. I also put myself in a position where I was irritable, restless, and discontent. And so when those instances took place and I encountered those people, I was not able to address it gracefully. But, you know, maybe one day I will get a 10-step practice. My best practice for the 10th step is restraint, pen and tongue, and mostly email. I will write out the email, I will erase it, I will write it out again, and I will admit that a lot of times I have to send it. I send it to somebody else who probably has a list of my emails that should not ever be shown to anybody, but God, doesn't it feel good to hit send? But it feels good to hit send. It gives me that little bit of relief, but I'm like, thank God I didn't send it to who I wanted to send it to. It doesn't ever accomplish what I want it to accomplish, and it makes me feel like a jerk, and then I need to make amends. I have to promptly admit it. I don't have to make amends for the things that I think. Thank God. Thank God. So, you know, and because a lot of what I think should come out of my mouth, so I have to refrain that also. But I think that restraint is something that I've learned in here. I pat myself on the back. I've got about 5 minutes left, I think, and I maybe uttered a cuss word or two. That is not how I talk. But I was told to try to curb my language. We are in a church. I appreciate not offending other people, but, you know, I swear like a sailor, and I think there are plenty of times when that is the most appropriate and only appropriate way to talk to people. And certainly the only appropriate way that I get to express my feelings, honestly. So, step 11 is all through prayer and meditation. I don't have a real rigorous meditation practice. You know, I live a full life. I take care of myself physically. I get up in the morning, I dress myself. Quite actually, I usually dress myself at night, sleep in the clothes I'm going to wear the next day so I can get up and go. But I have a life that I could have never imagined. Karen always wanted me to talk about what my life is like now. And I will share that with you for the next, how much time? 3 minutes. Oh, Lord. You guys don't get to hear all about it. But I live alone. I have a piece of 5-acre property in Bellingham, Washington that has a view of Mount Baker. It is a slice of heaven. I do not like the weather in Bellingham. I really miss California and being down here, having this little pink tinge on my skin. I'm like, oh, thank you. But I live near my family. I'm there for my mother and father who are aging. My brother and sister-in-law live up there, and so does my 7-year-old niece. I will be there as long as my family is there. I also was able to build a barn. I have tiny horses. I am a horse girl. I have the equine gene, and I have 3 tiny horses and a miniature mule. You maybe have to give me 3 extra minutes, because when I got into tiny horses, I bought a tiny horse. She was the love of my life. I had her for 8 months, and she died. She was fine at 7:30 at night, and at 10 o'clock the next morning, I was on the way to the barn, and she was gone by the time I got there. God works miracles in my life, and I fortunately have been able to see when God takes something away, he has something better for me. I have been blessed to find that out relatively quickly, but as I was driving to the barn, I was like, good luck with this one, God. This is not the deal. Since then, I met a family, the veterinarian that helped me with my tiny horse. His 11-year-old daughter gave me their tiny horse. They were a Christian family. I got a free horse. I got a free veterinarian. This horse was the littlest a-hole that I could imagine. girl, but he was bigger. He learned how to pull a cart. I met a friend online who said, hey, do you want to learn how to drive miniature horses? Yes, I do. I might have a little bit of challenges, but she was up for it. I now have a cart, a four-wheeled cart that is pulled by a pair of miniature horses. We drive around, we go through coffee shops, we compete, we do crazy things. We go really fast and we call it A&A shenanigans. Right? We have a sign in the barn that says, that's a horrible idea. What time? And, you know, one other thing that I went through in my sobriety that I didn't know if I was ever going to recover from, I was out of the barn. We came back and I was looking for my service dog. I said, Jack, where are you? He had been hit by a car. I lost him immediately, instantaneously. I think God spared me from having to make a terrible choice, from having to watch him suffer. There were so many silver linings to that, but I lost him, and that was a month before I was going to get my next service dog. And so there was a great tragedy in my life. I have more tragedies to come in my life, but people from Alcoholics Anonymous were there. I went to the district meeting the day that that happened, and I said my service dog had died, but I'll bring pizza to the next district meeting. So what I was told to do in Alcoholics Anonymous was to show up. You guys have given back to me so much more than I could ever give, but I am grateful to be a part of this family. I'm grateful for you all to show up today, and love you. Thank you all.